a long list of people who helped us overcome our biggest challenge, earning links and amplification. Because each influencer had contributed, they were predisposed to help share the content. Our drought of awareness was over, and within months, nearly all of the websites where our respondents posted their own works had referenced ours. Not only that, but those links had the hoped-for impact. Moz, at the time using the SEOmoz.org domain, ranked number one for SEO ranking factors, Google ranking factors, search engine ranking factors, and a host of related keyword phrases that collectively drove thousands of monthly searches. We identified our flywheel. We found the point of friction, and we applied a growth hack to ease that friction and let the wheel start to spin faster. Today, this tactic of including influencers in the creation of content, often called roundups, is a staple of the content marketing practice. I'd even say it's massively overdone at this point. But 100 new creative opportunities await. When thinking about how to build a marketing process that's going to work for the long term, that can scale without friction, that can build on itself even as your business grows, consider the flywheel analogy. Each one will be different, and yours should be substantially unique from your competitors, built to take advantage of your particular skills and targeted to your specific audience. The hacks or marketing tactics you employ should be in service to this funnel, not instead of it. If you've got a great idea for a landing page or a referral program or a way to reach the right customers via a social network in a scalable manner, just make sure you know how to test, track, and apply it inside the funnel you're building. Growth hacks alone can't solve all your marketing problems, but the right ones may add immense value to an already humming marketing flywheel. Chapter 10. Real values don't help you make money in the short term. Corporate values, usually chosen by senior executives, are adopted to prevailing business circumstances and are not rooted in fundamental philosophical convictions, morality, or ethics. In this sense, corporate values are often selected as a strategy to rally the troops and therefore manipulative in nature. That's Ray Williams, 2010. My friend Rob Ousby once had a brilliant idea for how to make Moz millions of extra dollars each year. So why did I tell him, hell no, we're not doing that? Here's why, friends. In a SaaS business like Moz, churn is perhaps the most important, most studied number. It shows what percent of your customers are canceling their accounts each month or year. A high churn rate means you need to earn a lot of new customers just to make up for the ones who are leaving your service. A low churn rate means that growth is vastly easier and usually much faster. Investors in particular tend to value SaaS businesses like ours with low churn rates at far greater multiples than those with high churn. In 2011, our churn rate was about 8.5% per month, and we had about 10,000 subscribers. This meant that each month, we had to find 850 new subscribers to sign up just to maintain our revenue. If we wanted to grow, we needed even more. We were, in fact, signing up far more than 850 new customers each month, which enabled the business to scale quickly despite the high churn rate. But we were scared about the inevitable consequences of such a brief customer engagement. On average, folks stayed with their Moz subscriptions for about 11 months. Based on some research, we estimated there were close to 1 million potential Moz customers in the English-speaking world. But it's not hard to imagine how, in a few years of thousands of monthly signups, we could work our way through a significant portion of that group and put the long-term future of the business in jeopardy. We needed to make our subscriptions stickier and provide value to our customers such that they'd want to stay with us for multiple years. That's where Rob came in. "Why," he asked, "do you let people cancel with a click right on the website?" "You think we should make it harder to cancel?" I replied. If you change the cancellation process to a phone call, Rob explained, I'm willing to bet that friction alone will improve your monthly churn rate. Plus, you can then talk to folks as they're canceling and get a much better understanding of who they are and why they're leaving. You could probably save a good number of them too, or get them back as customers again in the future. Maybe switch some to a cheaper plan or convince them to buy a different product from you. I'd seen some stats that backed up Rob's guess and told him so. You're right. Making the subscription cancelable only by phone can have a real impact on churn rate. But we all hate services that require a phone call to cancel after a purely online sign-up. They're intentionally making it difficult. It's not empathetic, and that means it's not tag fee. Fair enough, Rob replied, but you're leaving a lot of money on the table. Well, I answered, we always say, they're not core values if you're willing to sacrifice them in exchange for money. Yes, but is it tag fee? Values may not make you money in the short term, but they're invaluable to any business in the long term. Values are not always easy. They force hard decisions. They can work against short-term growth. They restrict paths that might otherwise be open to pursuit. Establishing and adhering to core values carries great intrinsic and extrinsic benefits. But usually these become evident over the long term, and that can be immensely frustrating for startups struggling simply to stay alive long enough to get to profitability or fundraising. This tension is hard. But my experience and the correlation of values adherence to performance suggests it's worth it. Plus, sticking to values makes it possible to look in the mirror without hating the person staring back. At Moz, we have six core values, represented by the acronym TAGFEE. Transparency, authenticity, generosity, fun, empathy, and the exception. These are the beliefs we prioritize above the success or growth of the business. TAGFEE acts as a litmus test for whether we should or shouldn't take an action, hire or let someone go from the team, or create a process or policy. We use it in everyday discussion about the content we put on our website, the ways we engage with our community, the products we build, and the internal actions we take. TAGFEE started in 2007 when Moz's first investor, Michelle Goldberg, gave me a copy of Good to Great, Jim Collins's classic analysis of the elements that correlated with companies that achieved long-lasting greatness versus those that didn't. In his research, Collins identified seven characteristics highly correlated with companies that have remarkable financial and growth performance over long periods. One of these, which Collins called first who, then what, posits that great organizations are made up of people who share fundamental core values and use these as their guiding light for decisions, big and small. Everything I've experienced as an entrepreneur, a CEO, an individual contributor, and a student of startups and business culture reinforces this concept. People who share core values and believe those values to be the most important part of their contribution to the world have the greatest potential to accomplish remarkable things together. And conversely, when individuals in an organization don't align to the same values, every goal, project, and effort is undermined. Success in any form is made massively harder or easier depending on the degree to which your team, in the deepest part of their personal beliefs, shares an unwavering commitment to the same values and agrees with the implications of what values mean to an organization. This quote sums it up. The core values embodied in our credo might be a competitive advantage, but that is not why we have them. We have them because they define for us what we stand for, and we would hold them even if they became a competitive disadvantage in certain situations. That's Ralph Larson, former CEO of Johnson & Johnson. Moz, in its early days as a software company, latched onto this idea And I believe we have always been at our best when we embraced and embodied our core values. And we're often at our worst when we strayed from them. Geraldine is Tagfi's author. That might come as a surprise, but she was a copywriter by background and is now the published author of All Over the Place, Adventures in Travel, True Love, and Petty Theft. You should probably get a couple copies in case you want to read it more than once. When we started down the path of identifying Moz's core values, she was an obvious choice to assist. She knew me incredibly well. She was familiar with the company and all 11 of our employees at the time. She was a talented writer, and she didn't charge very much. Important to an early-stage startup. Each of Moz's employees went through a written exercise, listing the traits and qualities we admired most in others and aspired to ourselves. We talked together about what we wanted to be as a company, what we wanted to stand for, and what we regretted from our pasts, personally and professionally. The notes from these exercises and discussions were passed on to Geraldine, who transformed them into a written document that we then shared, edited, commented on, and returned to her for a final version. It begins, Moz's Guiding Principles. This document represents the rules we have created and ideals we strive towards for all the work we produce as a company. We embrace these as the embodiment of who we are, why we exist, and what we endeavor to achieve in every arena, from software to website content to actions in the workplace and on the road as representatives of Moz. And the six values themselves are transparency. We believe in sharing what we know, learn, and do with everyone who's interested. We reject secrecy, obscurity, and opacity in all its forms and strive instead to make the worlds of marketing, of SEO, of software startups, and of Moz itself open and accessible to all. Authenticity. We hate pretending to be people we're not, or hiding our true identities, thoughts, or feelings in our work. We despise corporate, inauthentic behavior and the trappings of the business world that hold back our humanity or diversity. We will always work to make Moz a place where all of us can be our real selves. Generosity. We believe in giving back without asking for anything in return. Our goal, greater even than growth or financial success, is to help make our peers, coworkers, and the world of marketing a better, more nurturing, giving environment. Fun. The work we do can be challenging and stressful, but we believe work is only work if you make it so. We aim to make our jobs and the jobs of those around us enjoyable, rewarding, and humor-filled. Empathy. Our most important value, empathy, demands that we put ourselves in the shoes of others and see things from their point of view. We endeavor to create products, content, interactions, and environments that are welcoming and respectful to all. We believe the best kind of empathy is that which aims for the most long-term good, not just a short-term veneer of niceness. Our goal is to apply this empathy with the highest priority to our community, audience, and customers, then to ourselves, and finally to our shareholders and investors. The exception. If everyone else is doing something one way, we believe there's innate value in finding an alternative path. Moz strives to be unique, innovative, and weird. We cut against the grain and hope to stand out as an exception to the rule. You can find the original version online in a blog post I published a little more than a year after its original creation. It's very possible that Tagfi's values resonate with you personally, but it's also completely okay if they don't. No two organizations should have precisely the same values, and values should not be arbitrarily created and then forced upon a team. Moz's values have worked for us because they came from a deeply personal place inside its founders' and early employees' beliefs, shaped by our experiences as people and professionals. They are not designed to work for everyone or appeal to everyone. Core values have proven their worth to me as a founder, CEO, and employee, because they provide three powerful, unifying organizational forces. The first is a shared commitment among the team. In a company with hundreds of people, there will naturally be tension, disagreement, and occasional discord. But core values help everyone know, from the day they're first interviewed, that unifying beliefs bind us together. Even when we disagree on how to accomplish our goals, or on whether we have the right goals, we at least know that our deepest foundation is the same. My in-laws fight constantly about pretty much everything, usually in their native Italian, so I catch only every third or fourth word. But they all agree when it comes to politics, a rare thing in American families. That shared consensus of the most important parts of what's right and wrong for the world and its people can take a Thanksgiving dinner going off the rails and bring everyone back together. The same is true at a company with resonant shared values. The second is a set of blueprints for decision-making. When we're faced with a challenging decision, lots of data, intuition, and analysis will naturally be a part of the process. But these can be powerfully bolstered with our values acting as guardrails we stay inside. As with the example from this chapter's opening of requiring a phone call to cancel, we are able to use our values to help determine how to invest in improving the company, its products, its people, and its growth. I'll share some more examples of this process later in this chapter and in the book. The third is evaluation criteria for retrospection. Most companies do some kind of retrospecting, looking back at previous decisions, projects, and investments to determine whether they were worthwhile, and use inputs like return on investment, cost-benefit analysis, and other varieties of metrics depending on the circumstance. The addition of fit with core values to these operations delivers a special kind of insight, and one that both helps reinforce those values and sets up future investments for better success. Consistency and commitment loom large in the human psyche, and when it's perceived by your internal team, external customers, and wider audience that your organization maintains them, your brand benefits. We hold these core values to be self-evident. Values-driven organizations have proven that even in the early days, there is an unassailable magic that comes from having the right people on the team and for those people to share a set of common values, alongside a shared mission and vision. The all-too-common problem comes when founders and leaders believe that recruiting can be separated from values alignment. Collins explains this brilliantly in his essay on aligning action. In describing the alignment process, I have assumed that your organization's core values are already clearly defined, a big assumption. Let me make a few points about identifying core values, for without this stake firmly in the ground, there can be no effective alignment. First, you cannot set organizational values. You can only discover them. Nor can you install new core values into people. Core values are not something people buy into. People must be predisposed to holding them. Executives often ask me, how do we get people to share our core values? You don't. Instead, the task is to find people who are already predisposed to sharing your core values. You must attract and then retain these people and let those who aren't predisposed to sharing your core values go elsewhere. That's Jim Collins, Aligning Action and Values. I don't think there's an easier or more tempting mistake to make than to hire someone who has great ability or a great track record of performance with the recognition that while they're not a match with the current values and culture of the company, over time, you believe you can bring them into alignment. I've made this same arrogant move multiple times over my career, and each time it ended in something between disappointment and disaster. In the professional world, we're accustomed to hiring for competence. It's been drilled into us by popular culture and long-held business practices that the goal of hiring is to recruit someone to the team who has demonstrated skill and experience in a similar role. That's not a terrible thing to include in a hiring process, but if you want extraordinary results, it can't be the only thing you seek out. Instead, you need a hiring process that considers core values and broad culture fit. Don't arrogantly presume you can transform a person who isn't predisposed to believe in or share your core values into someone who is. Build that screening into your interview process, your onboarding process, and the way in which contributions are judged. Use it to inform how raises, recognition, and promotions are given. That's the only way you'll prove to your team that values are on par with work output. Values demand vigilance. It's oh so tempting to let a few values mismatches and clashes slide because an employee is doing high quality work or has skills that seem hard to replace. But every time we've done this at Moz, it's backfired. Sometimes it's quick and the damage is minimal, but other times we've kept someone around far past the time they'd proven their values to conflict with our own. It wreaks havoc on morale. Take Maya Angelou's advice. When someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time. A few years ago, Moz hired a longtime veteran of a big software company. He came highly recommended with a number of leadership positions on successful products in his past. But early on, he clashed with a number of folks on the team. He played politics well, though, and neither his managers nor the broader Moz leadership felt his transgressions were untenable. Unfortunately, his peers and subordinates at the company, especially those not on his team, came to feel that Moz's commitment to TAGFI and to upholding core values must be slipping. They assumed, given that we'd recently raised a large round of venture financing, that people like this guy were the new normal. And it wasn't that leadership didn't know about his cultural mismatch. It was that they just didn't care as much anymore. So long as he performed, they figured, we'd keep him around. In their eyes, Moz lost some of its magic, and its leadership lost some of their credibility, especially on values issues. I found out only after he left that in addition to these professional conflicts, he'd made sexist remarks and jokes to some of the young women on our team. He'd brought up inappropriate subjects at the office, sent around borderline offensive memes and links, and verbally bullied people who'd since left the company. I was heartbroken. I asked our head of HR why she'd never mentioned any of these things or taken action. Her response shocked me. "You're the first person I've ever heard this from," she said. "A few people have complained about him, but never with these specifics." His behavior had gone unreported. I asked a couple of the folks who told me about it why they'd never raised these events with their manager or with HR. Those replies were even more heartbreaking. "I didn't think it would do anything. And worse, I figured everyone knew but didn't care so long as his projects did well." Hearing stuff like that was like a knife in my gut. This company I'd built, that I'd worked so hard to make into a place that cared about people and values, had clearly changed. It wasn't because we'd hired dozens of vindictive or evil assholes. It was because letting even a few people, and this example I'm sharing sadly wasn't alone, break our core values repeatedly without visible action from leadership led to the normalization of discordant behavior. There are three common ways values fail at organizations. First is when they're viewed by the team as merely paper platitudes, hung on a plaque on the wall, but not consistently enforced. If you overlook your stated values when they come into conflict with an employee who's performing well, or perceived by managers to be performing well, you're revealing reality, that performance, or perception in politicking, matters more than embraced values. Second is when those values are created because the founders or executives thought they'd help build the cult-like environments that Silicon Valley culture broadcasts as a must-have element of startup recruiting and retention. You've almost certainly seen or heard about companies whose values have become the stuff of parody. Values like hustle, work hard, play hard, get shit done, and always be shipping. If any values you hold deeply are ones that, even if you found them to be a competitive disadvantage, you'd still uphold despite that conflict, then by all means, keep them. But if your company's values are merely marketing for potential hires, don't call them values. Be honest with yourself and your staff. Make them part of your recruiting materials and your internal lingo if you must. But don't attempt to pull the wool over your own eyes and everyone else's by calling them something they're not. Real values have costs. They're difficult to embody. A lot of people, but hopefully not the ones you recruit, will disagree with them. People internally and externally should, at least some of the time, view them as a barrier to making a financially beneficial decision. Real values are truths you hold to be more important than making money. They will come into conflict, and you'll have to make that hard decision and show everyone on your team why you're choosing that path. Not just once, but over and over in order to instill the idea that values mean something at your organization. Because usually, they don't. People who've been in the professional world for even a few years get pretty jaded about company values. That means you have to go above and beyond to prove that you take them seriously. If you're not willing to sacrifice and to make money-costing and painful decisions that bias to your values, don't bother having them. Say instead that your core values are financial growth and monetary success. You'll attract like-minded people who appreciate your honesty. When you fail to live up to the expectations you've created with value statements, no amount of pretending can distract the incredibly talented, smart people that startups recruit from the uncomfortable truth that these so-called values can be willfully violated so long as the real goals, financial or otherwise, are met. Real values are proven through hard decisions and reinforced through recognition of times when they've caused real pain and still been the right call. When your employees go out for drinks and bemoan the loss of revenue or opportunity and say, "Well, I guess they really believe in X more than just making money," that's when you know real core values are a part of your organization. Third is when values aren't publicized at all and must be discovered over time through trial and error or by watching the reactions of scared employees in meetings with management. Working in environments like this is frustrating, tiring, and off-putting for those who can't quickly learn or keep up with the system. Every company has unspoken rules or idiosyncrasies that take time to learn, but values should be explicit because they act like the operating system for a person's employment, affecting every action and decision they make. When you force people to figure out a secret, unwritten code for behavior, you are guaranteed to drive away a fair portion of otherwise talented contributors. Worse still, all the benefits you could achieve from recruiting and hiring with explicit values are forfeit. If you can't be bothered to identify, amplify, and reward your beliefs, there's no way for your recruiting process to seek out those shared beliefs in new employees. A team with shared culture and shared values will, almost always, outperform a team without these elements. Why? First, retention. It's far more difficult to retain team members who fundamentally disagree with how things should be done and why, even if they agree on what work to do. And constantly rebuilding a team through hiring is both exhausting and inefficient. People do their best work a year or two into working together with the same group. They learn one another's intricacies and idiosyncrasies, anticipate needs, establish efficient communication and process patterns, and know what works and doesn't for their teammates. According to Namely's analysis of more than 20,000 startups in the United States, average employee tenure is only 10.8 months. 10.8 months? If you can improve yours, you'll have a powerful competitive advantage. Second, motivation. The difference between working with people you like, trust, and agree with versus working with those whose tactics, style, and ethics you question is immense. The former promotes the assumption of good intent, among the most critical elements for team bonding, productivity, and quality of output. The latter fosters political environments where work quality suffers. Third, cohesion. it is massively easier to ask a team to commit to a roadmap, a project, or a process, even when they disagree, if core values and culture already bind you together. When those elements are lacking, so too is the basic structure for what makes a compelling argument, or what elements should be part of decision-making, or which paths are available and worthy of consideration. Homogeneity hobbles innovation. There is one big fatal flaw that often accompanies the pursuit of shared culture and values. Uniformity. Startups and early-stage ventures need diversity. I mean that both in the sociological sense, that is, not just young white men from the same country and background, and in the broader thought pattern and experience sense, that is, everyone in the company thinking the same way and bringing only a single set of professional or personal experiences. These two might seem at odds, diversity versus shared culture. They are not. In fact, shared culture combined with diversity should be exactly the combination you're seeking in a team. Diversity, culture, and values might sound like a complex, tough combination. I agree, it's challenging to build a team with these attributes, especially if your own background lacks exposure to diverse people and or those who share your values. But real magic happens when these come together. A major roadblock is the easy-to-make assumption that diversity of employees, especially early on, isn't desirable because it conflicts with or contradicts the goals of shared culture. When I hear this pushback from founders, it gets my blood boiling. This is a fundamental misinterpretation of what culture, values, and diversity mean. When we talk about diversity in a founding team or an early-stage organization or a larger company, we're talking about recruiting and hiring a wide range of people from different backgrounds, ethnicities, ages, genders, and identities in all their forms. People with these varied attributes are not fundamentally at odds with your culture or your values. Women of color and disabled veterans and Asian men in their 60s and young people with non-binary gender identification can all share the same core values and believe the same things about how a company should be structured and how people can work together. I'm not saying that every randomly assembled group of diverse people, or every randomly assembled group of straight white cisgendered men in their 30s from New York, will share these beliefs. I'm saying that recruiting diverse people who do share these beliefs is a massive advantage, a cheat code for your organization. Diversity is immensely desirable because it improves perspective, empathy, and creativity. A diverse group brings unique life experiences and, as a result, a unique ability to contribute that non-diverse groups can't match. It's often hard to know when you're benefiting from diversity or when you're being hurt by lack of it, because the input given by people is seldom directly attributable to their background. But I'll give six short examples. 1. When we started recruiting to grow the company, gender diversity made a big difference. My mom was my co-founder. Sarah was my COO. Our board comprised more women than men until 2012. That meant Moz was seen in Seattle as a place where women in the startup world were welcomed and encouraged. I hired a woman, Kate Matsudaira, as our vice president of engineering in 2009. She was a critical hire who seriously upgraded our engineering practices. I suspect I never could have swayed her to join an all-dude company. The same held true for many other folks we brought aboard, junior and senior, technical and not. Imagine excluding 50% or more of your potential workforce because you recruited only your same-sex drinking buddies. Not a smart move given how hard it is to hire in our world. 2. In developing personas for our products, we started with what can only be called the whitest, most generic naming conventions ever. Thankfully, some more thoughtful and diverse Mozers noticed this convention and noted the subtle effects that subtle biases like names and genders, even in fictional characters like personas, can have on how we perceive the world of our customers and design for them. If a persona is called College Grad Chad, there's a certain associated gender and background identity for most folks. Our designers assumed Chad could read small text. Our engineers assumed Chad was familiar with advanced query modifiers. Our marketers assumed Chad was active on Twitter and Instagram. By moving to more inclusive persona naming conventions and descriptions, we brought to the process a more accurate view of the diversity of the customers we were actually designing for, building more accessible products and marketing them more thoughtfully in the right places and ways. 3. At one of Moz's executive team lunches some years back, someone brought up the city of Seattle's decision to stop using the term brown bag to describe lunchtime presentations. I thought it was very odd, until our CTO at the time, Anthony, who's black, noted that the phrase was used to segment and classify people based on the color of their skin, and he'd personally been subjected to it as a kid in Eastern Washington. We immediately got rid of the term at Moz and switched to lunch and learn, which has the added benefit of being much more understandable to our non-American-born employees and guests. 4. At another executive meeting, we were all talking about the various tribes at Moz, a term we'd been using to denote groups across teams that work together on projects. Annette, our CMO, whose background is American Indian, wondered if we could choose another word to describe these groups. Cue another head-smacking minute and a shift in terminology. 5. When Sarah, now our CEO, at the time COO, was pregnant with her son, she noticed the lack of private rooms at Moz where moms and moms-to-be could comfortably take care of themselves or their kids, and that restroom stalls were not an option. That pain and awareness caused us to correct the issue with rooms specifically for that purpose. But if she hadn't been part of the office design team, it's very possible we wouldn't have been sensitive to the issue. 6. Finally, and perhaps most broadly, in a design review of the first version of Moz Analytics, one of our software tools, Sarah and a number of other women on our teams who looked at the product took exception to several elements of the design, color, layout, font usage, and word choices. When we modified these in response to their input, metrics improved. David Mim, whose company we acquired in 2012 and who is partially colorblind, helped identify which contrast variations he literally couldn't see. Martin York, one of our senior engineers who has dyslexia, commented on form inputs missing auto corrections for common mistypings. One of the older members of our team noted that she had difficulty in parsing the text because the lines were too close together, aka overly tight leading. I couldn't have caught these issues myself, and neither could a team of people with my background, gender, age, or abilities. Diversity made our product more accessible, improved engagement, and reduced customer frustration. This is why diversity is so well correlated with success everywhere, from early-stage startups to Fortune 500 boards of directors. Research from McKinsey showed that more gender-diverse companies outperform their less gender-diverse peers by 15%, while more racially diverse teams outperform their peers by 35%. PE Hub, Venture Capital Journal, and Women VC published a joint report analyzing the returns of investment funds with gender-diverse versus mostly male and all-male investor teams, and found the more balanced teams had returns 3.78 times higher than their less balanced peers. When First Round Capital analyzed the performance of the hundreds of investments in its own portfolio, it found that teams with at least one woman founder performed 63% better than all-male founding teams. If I were founding a new startup today, I'd do almost anything to have a feature that's 63% higher correlated with better performance. Where founders need to seek out shared attributes isn't in what we look like or where we're from. Instead, focus on ethical beliefs and the right ways to operate a company. You want a team that has significant overlap in its answers to questions like, what traits and behaviors should be rewarded and recognized in our employees? Which ones should be discouraged? What criteria should be applied to people we hire, those we promote, and those we let go? What makes someone a good person versus a bad person? How should hard-to-resolve conflicts be handled at our organization? What's your preferred form of communication, and why? What enables you to deliver your best work? What stops you from it? You've probably seen stories in the tech press about how a startup is asking potential hires about Star Wars versus Star Trek, or which craft beers they prefer, or what sports they watch, in order to help determine culture fit. These types of questions are awful. Not only because they promote homogeneity of thinking, we're all from the same town and love the same soccer team and the same video games, is not the kind of shared culture that will help your organization succeed, but because they, intentionally or not, bias to people with homogeneity of experience, too. 20-something white men from upper middle class and wealthy upbringings are the most plentiful founders in the technology world. I fit into this group myself. My dad was an engineer at Boeing. My mom was a designer, a marketer, and an owner of her own small business. They're both ethnically Jewish, but not practicing. My parents made decent money and were extremely thrifty, enabling them to pay for college for all three of their kids, though only one of us, my sister, actually graduated. We grew up in a rural area outside Seattle, and I get how tempting it is to find someone like me as a co-founder for a new venture. I already know lots of other white and Asian men in the Seattle area who grew up in middle-class families, are in their mid-30s, don't have kids, like computer games, and cheer for the Seahawks. What's wrong with starting a company with friends I already have, whom I know I get along with, and whose interests and passions match my own? It's not additive. Together, my peers and I of similar background and identity combine for only a very slight bit of extra perspective. Try as we might, our outlooks and our framing of events will be colored by who we are, where we've lived, what we've experienced. The benefits of diversity will be generally lost to us. And, as a result, our ability to empathize with, design for, market to, and serve broader groups with whatever we make will be limited. Additionally, we'll almost certainly find it harder to recruit diverse early employees, which will have a domino effect on our hiring and team composition for the long term. If you wonder why so many startups are so homogenous, or why so many serve only to address the problems of a very thin slice of the world's populace, look no further. It's usually not intentional, evil, biased hiring practices, but rather deep-rooted, systemic drivers like the design of interview questions and where job postings are placed and the practice of recruiting through friends and family networks. Moz itself struggled massively with diversity, especially on the technical side. I think this is because we unintentionally fell prey to all of these inherent biases. We looked for familiar experiences. We sought out many of our early employees through the people we already knew. We made no intentional efforts to create a diverse pool of candidates from which we could hire. Like many companies, we didn't think much about diversity for years until, one day, we did. And it looked awful. In 2012, more than 90% of all of Moz's engineering hires were white or Asian men in their 20s and 30s. We could have been the poster child for stereotypical tech monocultures. And this was despite having a woman, Kate, and then a black man, Anthony, serve as CTO. We didn't just struggle on the diversity front, though. We struggled on shared culture and values, too. We'd hire people for their experience, skills, and ability without a consistent, intentional process to determine whether they supported TagFee or agreed with how we did things at Moz. We addressed both issues in the space of a year. First, we built a new process called the TagFee screen, wherein members of a team not making the hire would spend time with candidates during an interview day and have discussions designed to elicit alignment with our values and our culture. For example, if our big data engineering team was interviewing a candidate, that person might go out to lunch with two folks from customer support to talk about values and culture issues. If the customer support interviewers had substantial concerns about the engineer's proclivity toward or away from TagFee and Moz's people-centric culture, they could veto that hire, even if the engineering team thought the candidate was a perfect skills match. Next, we looked into our practices around diversity. we found, not surprisingly, that a high proportion of our candidates were sourced internally through referrals. And of course, few of those candidates had any diversity of background or experience. They went to the same schools, lived in the same places, had the same sorts of upbringings, etc., as our existing team. We made a number of intentional efforts to change by investing in and supporting local programs aimed at promoting diversity. These included Returnship, a program for parents, usually moms, returning to work after a few years off for childcare. Ada Developers Academy, a program for women learning to code that we hosted at our offices. And TAF Academy, a school program to help get kids from underprivileged backgrounds access to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education. Our goal was to gain exposure to potential candidates whom we'd otherwise miss. The results were remarkable. A couple of years after implementing, our engineering organization has improved gender balance and background diversity, more than tripling the number of people of color and women engineers on the team, though we still have a long way to go. Other parts of the company, customer success, finance, marketing, product, and facilities, have become more diverse too. We've discovered places to post jobs we never knew about, language that was holding back diverse candidates from applying, and new networks of people to help us attract broader groups of applicants. Pro tip. We use and love Textio on the web at textio.com to analyze our job postings, about page, and other recruiting-focused content to make sure we're using inclusive, unbiased language. It's worth checking out and has a number of free and low-cost options. On the shared values and culture front, we've shown similar improvement. From 2011 to 2013, we hired very fast. This brought a cohort of Moz employees who reported less job satisfaction and had higher voluntary turnover than prior cohorts. That is, those folks were more likely to leave the company in a shorter period of time. After the implementation of our tag fee screens and our more considered focus on culture and values in the interview and hiring process, we improved voluntary retention. We have, in my opinion, also improved the caliber of new employees joining the team. Teams work better together, get more done, and produce higher quality results than ever before. If you're building a team from scratch or are in the early stages of recruiting and hiring, I hope you'll learn from our mistakes and from the data. Hire people who share a belief of what deserves a promotion and a raise versus a reprimand or coaching. Hire people who are naturally inclined toward your values and who want a place that's willing to sacrifice short-term growth or financial success in exchange for adherence to them. But don't hire only the people who look like you and see the world through the same set of experiences. Bolster your potential for high performance and for broader customer empathy by intentionally seeking out diversity. These two elements, when combined, forge the underpinnings of a remarkable team. Chapter 11. Living the lives of your customers and their influencers is a startup cheat code. A great way to build software is to start out by solving your own problems. You'll be the target audience, and you'll know what's important and what's not. That gives you a great head start on delivering a breakout product. That's Jason Fried, March 2006. I thought I had an amazing idea. I thought it was going to change the world of marketing. I thought we were going to build a set of software that every business needed. I thought it would catapult Moz's growth and revenues. I thought wrong. It was 2011 when Adam Feldstein, then Moz's chief product officer, and I sat down to plan out a project we called Moz Analytics. The new product stemmed from a theory I had that in the near future, the siloed practices of social media marketing, search engine optimization, content marketing, public relations, and online brand marketing would all merge into a single set of tactics undertaken by the same person or group at an organization. I saw how social media and content marketing work together to bolster each other. I wrote and talked at conferences about how many PR and brand building efforts were merging with SEO. I saw how a few organizations had already combined these practices into remarkable flywheels that generated returns greater than the sum of their parts. I knew these practitioners would need tools that worked together to optimize their efforts, track their progress, and compare themselves against the competition. Notice how I never thought to validate my idea externally, how nearly every sentence in the passage begins with "I." You can almost picture the train wreck on the horizon. The case of the disappearing conversions. In November 2013, after more than 2 years of planning and development, we finally released Moz Analytics. More than 90,000 people had seen a preview of the product and signed up to get notified of the launch. It was by far our most successful product marketing campaign, and the buzz from our community felt extraordinary. Every day, we found new, speculative discussions about what might be in the product or how it might help with their work. It felt like we were releasing a blockbuster movie rather than a business tool for marketing professionals. But internally, we were struggling. The delivery date slipped 5 different times. We'd had to replace our engineering lead on the product. Features were cut, then whole sections of the product were cut. The version we released was buggy and incomplete. But worse than that, it wasn't what our customers wanted. That month, I delivered an all-hands presentation, my last one as CEO, to the Moz team, detailing what had gone wrong and where we stood. Here was the setup. Our budget for the invite list includes 90,545 emails. If approximately 5% of those convert, we will have 4,500 signups. And here's the kicker. The invite list's actual performance had 90,545 emails. Of those, 97.31% were delivered. Of those, 30.45% clicked through. Of those, 18.85% took a free trial. And of those, 41% converted to paid subscriptions. Of the 90,545 folks who'd said they were interested in our new product, only 2.3% actually paid for at least a month of the service. Worse still, those customers tended to quit the subscription far earlier than customers of our prior product. It was almost a year of additional work before the new product was performing as well for our customers or our bottom line as our previous one. What did we get wrong? First, we built software in the worst possible way. Rather than creating a small kernel of the eventual finished product, then iterating and adding until we had a satisfyingly useful and high-quality deliverable, we designed a massive scope of work and asked large groups of engineers, both internal and contracted, to work on separate pieces that would then supposedly fit together. Multiple contractor groups failed to deliver what we needed. So too did multiple internal engineering groups. Everyone was demoralized. Dates were moved back by months at a time. We had no ability to show off any version of the toolset until just a few weeks before the final launch, costing us invaluable customer feedback and time to make things better or rethink the product. Second, because of our delays, we felt insurmountable pressure to release as soon as possible. Even though customer testing a few weeks before launch revealed loads of bugs and dissatisfaction, our morale as a company and leadership team was so low that we were desperate for a release. We figured we could launch with a good enough product, then iterate until it was great. But guess what? People judge by first impressions. When those 26,832 people visited the page announcing Moz Analytics and showing off what it could do, most of them disappeared, never to return. Many who tried the product came away unimpressed. The word on the street, or in our case the web forums, conference halls, and social media discussions, said Moz had a crappy new product that wasn't worth the money. That reputation dogged us for 3 long, growth-stunted years. Third, we spent years building a product based entirely around a theory, one that proved to ultimately be false. 5 years after my prediction that social media marketing, SEO, content strategy, PR, and all those other earned media practices would combine and be the responsibility of a single person or team, online marketing remains as specialization heavy as ever. I was so confident in my knowledge of the field and my ability to predict what people needed that I failed to do the real research required to validate those assumptions. Instead of spending time with my customers and potential customers, I spent it with my product designers and engineers, dreaming up wild new things we could build. It wasn't until October 2013, just a few weeks before we released that doomed product, that I did what I should have done years before. Put myself in our customers' shoes. If you're ever tasked with a large software project, learn from our mistake. Pare back your design until it's the smallest possible element of what you eventually hope to have. Show that to people you trust and get their feedback. Iterate on the fundamentals. Then build it one element at a time. Add functionality, data, features, visual elements, etc., until you've got something new to show your trusted advisors and beta customers. But don't release it broadly until the buzz you're getting from these groups is firmly in the "we love this and can't live without it" camp. That time we reenacted the 80s classic, Trading Places. Wilfred Reynolds is the founder of Seer Interactive, a 150-person web marketing agency in Philadelphia with a stellar reputation, 10 years of steady growth, and a vast array of impressive client work. Will and I have been friends for many years, having spent time together at numerous events and finding our way to more than a few dinners and after-hours gatherings. We both have strong opinions, a desire to make the world of marketing a better place, and experience building companies from the ground up. Somehow, one night in 2012, at a drinking hole in Philadelphia, we'd shared a few whiskeys and decided that the following October, we'd each take a week off from our own lives to inhabit the others. It's the kind of conversation that usually never makes it out of the pub. We'll answer each other's emails. We'll live at each other's houses. We won't just be CEO in name only. We'll have real decision-making authority. When we woke up and sobered up, it somehow still seemed like a good idea. So we made it a reality. On Friday, October 4th, I flew to Philadelphia with Geraldine. We took a cab to Will's house in Northern Liberties. I learned how to care for his dog, Coltrane. Will learned that, because we traveled so much, we'd already killed all our houseplants. We swapped email logins and critical passwords. We walked each other through the major projects and meetings on our schedules. We traded house keys. And on Saturday, Will flew to Seattle and moved into our Capitol Hill apartment. That week was indescribably challenging, intense, and rewarding. Managing another human being's email by itself was a massive undertaking. I had to research new people, learn about projects, reach out to Will's coworkers to ask for help with context, and constantly flex my best judgment muscles. I replied to emails from Will's mom, with whom, delightfully, I'm still in occasional email contact to this day. I scheduled calls with new potential clients. I responded to team members and existing Seer clients who'd been instructed by Will to treat his email as though it were any other week. Will starts his days early. I'm a night owl. And because of the time zones, Will's schedule was already 3 hours ahead of mine. Getting to the office at the equivalent of 5 a.m. Seattle time took its toll, but I muddled through. Will's assistant, Stephanie, was both immensely kind and unflinchingly strict. She had me scheduled most of the days back-to-back with meetings, events, or one-on-ones of one kind or another. My amazing assistant